technology works. It's always fun to be back here. I hope you won't take offense at my putting an American flag on my presentation. That's actually more a commentary on the speaker than the venue. My mother was Canadian, so I have a certain affinity for things Canadian. To put it in perspective, when I was about 10 years old, we had to learn all of the states. At that point, I think there were only 48 of them, and their capitals and how to spell them. And my mother insisted that I must learn every province and every provincial capital and how to spell those as well. And I can still rattle off most of them. I can't remember the capital of Nunavut now, but that one came in later. I didn't know that at the time. So anyway, it's always good to be back here. I enjoy coming to Canada, and I find it quite fascinating. And I think it's, I've told people I had a number of strange experiences vis-a-vis my Canadian roots, in that I was in Michigan one time on a business trip, and I turned on the TV, and this is to tell you how far back it was. It was no remote, right? I was up at the TV turning the dial, and I turned and I turned and I turned. Something came up, and I flicked past it, and in just that split second, something electric was clearly in what I was looking at. And what was that? And I turned back, and it was a live broadcast of the parliamentary vote that resulted in the fall of the Joe Clark government. So, you know, that's one little sort of tidbit of Canadian history. I was also in Toronto on the day that Pierre Trudeau died, and I told, actually, Dan Risen was heard it from me. So, I mean, I have had these strange kinds of coincidental things having to do with Canada. So that's kind of the basis for my putting both flags on the presentation. Most of this presentation is something that I developed probably starting about 18 months ago, and I've honed it and modified it a bit. And I sort of changed the title slightly. That is, why risk management has lost credibility and what to do about it. And it's a somewhat unbalanced presentation, because I have all of one slide on the first half of the title, and the rest of the presentation is trying to address the second half of the title. So the first half of the title, why risk management has lost credibility. Well, some of you may have seen this cartoon, right? It says risk management department. And says, you're fired, as they walk in the door. And as they leave, they said, they didn't see that one coming either. So that's at least in part sort of why I think risk management has lost credibility, at least in some quarters. Now, in fairness, I think there are people who are down on risk management for all the wrong reasons, because there are people that have this kind of false impression that risk managers control risk, which is not really what risk managers are supposed to be doing. Risk managers are supposed to be gathering information, measuring, presenting the implications of the things that are being done by the people who are actually taking risky positions and various actions, so that hopefully the institution is taking risk that is informed, that is, you know, based on some sense of the nature of the risk versus the return. So in that sense, I think risk management probably takes more blame from certain quarters than is appropriate. But on the other hand, and there's a lot of blame to go around if we want to start talking down on that issue, but I think, in truth, there are some things that we as risk managers do need to stop and do a little thought about what might we have done wrong, and sort of what to do about it, and I put it in terms of things that we ignore at our peril. And I think in many cases, the five items I'm going to put down here are things that we probably, as a profession, were inclined to ignore, unfortunately, in the period leading up to this whole experience. So just listing them, the first is what I call statistical entropy, or the limits of statistical analysis. And I think to some extent Andy Lowe, who's a professor at MIT of finance and financial theory, recently said, he's not the first one to say it, that finance has to get over its physics envy, that we have to realize that finance is not physics. One of the subtle dangers is that 99%+ of the time, physics actually works pretty good in trying to analyze finance. It's just that little sliver at the end when it doesn't work that is oftentimes, as we see, pretty destructive. Second thing I think is that it's important as risk managers that we think about using our structural imagination. I think in some of the problems leading up to this whole crisis that began in 2007, 2008, many of us had a sense that an uneasiness that something just wasn't right, but we were too easily dissuaded. We were too easily allowed ourselves to be dismissed in terms of those structural ideas that were making us uneasy. Self-referential feedback. This is a problem again. I came in to risk management from a background in macroeconomic theory and model building and forecasting. And one of the things that macroeconomists do all the time is think about that, because you realize that you cannot model that in a formal way very effectively. You have to do that in terms of much more in terms of judgment. So I think that's something we need to look at more directly. Fourth lesson, I think, is the very tight connection between complexity and what I've come to refer to as dark risk. I used to call it secondary uncertainty, but Stuart Turnbull, who many of you will know from his publications, is a very state-of-the-art quant, told me that, no, that secondary uncertainty, that's not the right term. That sounds like that's secondary, that's not important, which, of course, was not the point. He's the one that came up with the term dark risk, which means he should have been a marketing executive. He obviously missed his calling, but anyway. Fifth lesson that I think we ignored is the importance of an alternate means of valuation. I'll talk a little bit about that. And then, basically, at the end, I'd like to take a look at something that I would consider a framework for assessing dark risk in future situations that might arise. And we'll see what you think of that, but I'd be interested in your reactions. Statistical entropy. First and foremost, statistical analysis can extract information from data, but it cannot create information that's not already in the data. Now, nobody's going to stand up and argue with me about that, I don't think. But the sad part is, it's not that difficult to go to conferences and see people make a complex presentation of some kind of analysis. And if you're not careful, you inadvertently walk away with the kind of unspoken sense that they've created some information that somehow wasn't in the data to begin with. Well, it doesn't work that way. The point is that, in a sense, like water, information can never rise higher than its source. And the source is the data from which you begin. So whenever you're sort of asking a question about results, that's the place to begin. Put another way, we are surrounded, all of us, every day, in all of our endeavors, by massive amounts of random disconnected bits of data. And in their raw form, they are practically useless. That is, they do not in any constructive way inform us about how to make better decisions. So we use various kinds of tools. We use statistical techniques. We build models. We try to look at structural relationships, and we do analysis that tries to tie those relationships together in some kind of a stable and structured way. And in the process, what we're doing is trying to extract from the data some kind of information that is informative to us as individual human beings and decision makers that allows us to make better decisions than we would otherwise. But again, everywhere and always, that is only a process of extraction of information, never a process of creating information. Now, an example, and of course this whole crisis went well beyond the subprime mortgage market in the U.S., but I do believe that is fundamentally where the structural problems originally built up that triggered the whole mess. And essentially, as you know, many of the tranches of these subprime mortgage portfolios were rated AAA. Now, in principle, that means, at least by two of the three agencies, in theory, there's a 1 in 10,000 chance of any failure of timely payment of principal and interest in the 12 months from the time of the assignment of the rating. 1 in 10,000 chance, 1 in 10,000 years. That's a pretty dramatic statement. I had the privilege of giving this presentation once in Egypt and once in Beijing, China. And in both cases, I emphasized the fact that that's about twice the length of the written history of either Egypt or China. right? So, I mean, it's a pretty breathtaking claim that, you're saying 1 in 10,000. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. Now, the super senior tranches of these things were supposedly better than AAA. So presumably it was less likely than 1 in 10,000 that you should ever get any kind of a problem. Well, I think, and I don't let the rating agencies off the hook here, but I do think we have to do a little independent thinking for ourselves. I think one of the things that we really should have been doing is asking, well, what was the empirical basis for such a rating? If we had to come up with some sense, a comment, some people will say you cannot make high-quality assets out of lousy collateral. I'm sorry, that's not true. I mean, subordination does work. If you think of subprime mortgages, these were really very poorly underwritten mortgages, but there was something real behind them. This wasn't some kind of a squirrely derivative contract where certain circumstances would, by the structure of the contract, mean it was absolutely worthless. There were physical houses, there was land, there were real, you know, tangible collateral things behind these portfolios. If you had had a contract that gave you the first 5 cents on every dollar that could be generated out of such a portfolio, that was an extremely high quality asset. The whole question was how much subordination is necessary to get your claim to a level of quality where the chance of any kind of failure of being paid back was down to something like 1 in 10,000. I'm sorry? Well, there was fraud and various things going on, but in fact, most of that was around the income of the borrowers and a variety of things like this, right? There were actual physical assets under there. So it's not like they were worthless, and it's not like subordination as a principle, as a concept, is not valid. The issue was always how much subordination was necessary to get to the point where your claim was high enough in the waterfall to be reasonably classified as AAA. Well, I decided I really wasn't involved in this whole area in detail at the time it was unfolding, but I decided when I went back to look at it, I would try something. And this is, I hasten to say, is not just simple, it's absolutely simplistic, okay? Because I didn't really have access to all the detailed data, so I just took what I could get for free and I did something which looked sort of reasonable. I took this chart. This is essentially outstanding foreclosures as a percent of total outstanding mortgage volume in different categories. And so at the bottom here, basically, you have traditional prime loans, VA loans, FHA loans, which are underwritten in more traditional ways. And needless to say, this was the pattern for the subprime mortgage market. And I sort of just said, what if I was to pretend, since foreclosures take a certain amount of time to work out, et cetera, I said, look, I've got 10 years of quarterly data here, that's 40 observations. What if I just pretended that these were 40 observations on annual default rates in this market? I know, don't press me too hard on that, but I said, just play the game, what would that be? And you'll see here, I mean, the high point here is about 9.5, 9.6. The low point is around 3 or so. The median is around 6%. So I said, okay, I took the data, and it turns out the mean is about 6, as I just pointed out. Standard deviation turns out to be just over 2. I said, well, now we need a theoretical distribution to try to fit these numbers. And so it has to be bounded at 0 because defaults can't be less than 0. So a log normal distribution is kind of the logical, you know, shape of the distribution to choose. And if you fit the log normal distribution with these characteristics, it looks rather like that. And I said, well, interesting enough. Okay, how far out to the right do I have to go in that distribution to get to 1/10,000th of the density of the distribution lying beyond that point? And lo and behold, it's about 20%. And strangely enough, it was somewhere around 20 to 25% subordination was the point at which these things began to be rated AAA. Now, I'm sure the rating agencies were doing something rather more complex and sophisticated than this. I mean, there was like, what, 300 or 400 or 500 pages of complicated mathematics they had in their documentation, so they must have been doing something somewhat more complicated than this. But the real point is that I think this is the spirit of what they were doing. This is the kind, you know, they were looking at data from the last 10, 15, maybe 20 years. We haven't really been creating these things much longer than that, and trying to look at the behavior of how this market worked in the context of the data in hand. But as I said, in what I just did here, the largest observation I had was less than 10% in the sample that I used to come up with that distribution. So how did we get this tail? Well, it was based on the shape of the assumption of the distribution that we assumed we would fit to the data. How many of you have read The Black Swan? That's pretty good. That's better than most audiences were asked that question. If you haven't, you should. Those who have will realize someone like me, who is a former econometric model builder and forecaster and one of the people who was involved in the very early days of building value at risk models, you have to have a reasonably thick skin to take Nassim Taleb lightly, okay? And I must confess, in the last few years, he's gotten mightily full of himself. But look, I think he did something very, very useful for risk management. He clearly grabbed onto an idea that hammered home to the general public and certainly to general management the importance of extreme events in a way that we as risk managers had failed to do over 15 years or so up to the time, 20 years really, up to the time the book was published. But one of the other key points that he makes, and I think it is a point that we definitely have to take to heart, is that the process of looking in detail at the middle 99 or 99.9% of the observations in a distribution and trying to fit those points with some theoretical distribution and then projecting that distribution deep into the tail and thinking that somehow that's giving us any useful information about how the real world behaves deep in the tail of the distribution is just foolishness. It just doesn't work, okay? Not in social scientific settings. The problem is that those extreme events are really the result of some kind of major regime change where the world is just a different place when that happens. And I think avoiding that kind of process and thinking that somehow we're doing something useful or robust is actually important. Now, second lesson, structural imagination. This whole process of subprime mortgage portfolio creation and underwriting and structuring in terms of waterfall payment structures, it worked actually quite remarkably well for a fair length of time. One of the important reasons was when they would build these portfolios, they were very careful to try to assemble underlying mortgages from a geographically diverse portion of the United States, urban versus rural, you know, different geographic areas. The point of argument being that we hadn't had a nationwide fall in prices across the board, countrywide, since the Great Depression. Now, 1 in 10,000 years, the Great Depression was 80 years ago. That's less than, okay, but maybe that should have been our benchmark for starters if you're taking 1 in 10,000 like benchmark. But so the argument, though, was if we have a diverse set of mortgages in the portfolio, that will immunize us against regional falls in housing prices. We've all, not all, but I've had the misfortune of selling two houses in my life into two different regional declines in housing prices, one in New York in the early 90s and one in Silicon Valley in the early 2000s. So I do realize that you can have declining home prices on a regional basis. And that was something that was generally understood, and that was the motivation for building these portfolios with a broad geographic distribution. So what happened then, if you built the portfolio that way, is up through roughly mid-2006, the reason that borrowers, even these kinds of subprime, somewhat, you know, marginal borrowers, would in fact default were generally idiosyncratic reasons. It might have been the death of the primary breadwinner in the family that basically devastated the family's finances. It might have been an uninsured property or casualty loss, loss of the car or whatever. Could have been, in the U.S., an uninsured medical bill that created problems. These were These were events that were largely, really completely, statistically independent across the borrowers in any given portfolio. Now, again, one of the things we've all, you know, we remember from statistics is the central limit theorem, that you have random events. They don't have to be nicely well-behaved. They can be virtually anything. If you consolidate enough of them, the average tends to settle down into a nice, well-behaved bell curve, provided one very important condition applies, that the random events are themselves statistically independent one from the other. Right? We always have to remember the caveats behind the nice theory that sort of seems to work so much of the time. So the real question, I think, is what unobserved contingency might have upset this very constructive pattern, which was kind of confining. You see, defaults in this market were high, much higher than they were in traditional mortgages, but for most of this period, they had actually, the standard deviation had been quite well contained. So the question really, I think, that we should have asked is, well, yeah, they were well contained as evidenced by the data in hand, but was there something that wasn't represented in the data that actually could have undermined that very beneficial diversification that was implicit in the behavior of the portfolio? Well, there was one candidate that was really pretty obvious in most everybody's mind, and that was if we had a general decline in housing prices throughout the country, then clearly that would hurt all borrowers in this market negatively. It would impact them negatively all at the same time. It's a classic case of the fundamental assumption of the statistical process that we've observed being suddenly violated. And you're simply going to get a process where now defaults would no longer be statistically independent. They would be driven by a common causal factor. Okay? Now, we are all too easily dismissed on it. Well, housing prices never fall. You know, well, might be useful to look at that. This is the Case-Shiller. This is the 10-city index, but the 20-city index is sort of similar. These are monthly data, year-over-year changes. So it's the percent change for this housing index in each month relative to the same month in the prior year. Okay? Mid-90s, basically fairly stable year over year. Inflation started up to 5, up to 10, up to 15, back down under 10, back to 15, dipped a little, actually hit 20%, and then trailed off fairly dramatically near the end. Now, what's interesting, if you actually look a little bit earlier, it was actually about 3.5 years in the early 90s. We didn't have big drops, but there was a period in here when year over year, this index, and this is not nationwide. This is not, you know, complete average home prices for the city as a whole, but it was, you know, basically a period when the housing prices were declining modestly to stable. So to say that home prices never fall on a fairly broad basis is just not really supported, even by data going back, you know, only that far. What's also interesting to me is that if you, instead of doing the 12-month change, which obviously masks a lot of activity on a monthly basis, what if we look at the month-to-month change? Well, in fact, month-to-month, at an annual rate, peak, there was actually some other peaks higher here, but near the end of this whole process, September 2005, was the local peak near the end. And then it started to trail off pretty dramatically. But what's really pretty incredible about this is if you look at the last 6 months of 2006, percent change is negative. The index was actually falling starting in July of 2006. And I'm not even going to, it's too disheartening to watch what happens after that, okay? I had a conversation at the big annual, you know, ICBI conference in December in Geneva in early December of 2007. And I spoke to the chief risk officer of one of the big U.S. pension funds. And I, you know, it was already getting a little rugged at that point. And I said, you know, how's it going? Well, he said, we're feeling pretty comfortable, all things considered. He said, we sold all of our subprime holdings in, I think it was early fourth quarter 2006. All right, well, that's pretty good. You know, why? How did you decide to do that? Well, the answer was we all got kind of nervous in a somewhat unstructured kind of way about what was happening in this market. And we decided, look, we just need to thrash this out. So they set up a half-day offsite. They all cleared their calendars. They turned off their phones. They did a four-hour session. They thrashed out all the aspects of it. And he said, at the end of the 4 hours, somebody asked a question to which nobody had an answer. And the question was, where's the upside? I mean, the prices had been going up because the spreads had been coming in to dramatically low levels, which just seemed hard to maintain. If you looked at the upside, meant they had to come in even farther, and they were kind of at historically low levels already. If they went back to anything like historical norms, there seemed to be a lot of downside. And they finally just said, you know, yeah, we might be getting a higher current yield, but I'm just not sure it's worth wearing the risk anymore. What's important is they had pretty sizable holdings, and they blew them out in 2 days, and they were gone. I mean, it was like there was that much liquidity in this market at the time. For individual organizations, there was time to get out of this market. Obviously, there were a lot of people that just were looking the other way. I mean, they weren't really aware of this at all. So, I mean, to me, the second lesson in terms of structural imagination is that if your structural imagination tells you that something's going on that just doesn't look right and feel right, doesn't necessarily mean that you have to insist that your company has to get out of this immediately. Probably as a risk manager, you couldn't do that anyway, all right? But I think the lesson is think about these significant variables that did not exhibit any serious negative behavior during the sample period that was used to arrive at your risk estimates. And for heaven's sakes, start to track those key variables carefully and make your organization aware of what's happening with these variables based on the fact that if they actually started to move in a very adverse direction, everyone might be prepared to agree that there were going to be problems. So at least let's know when those things are happening and be among the first organizations to be prepared to respond. I think the other reason why it's important is every organization takes time to get to pull the trigger, to get the organizational consensus to move away from something, especially when, you know, it still seems like everybody else is making a lot of money. It's not an easy decision to make. And the more you prepare the ground by getting people into the thought process of where and how it could go wrong and tracking the things that might be early warning indicators, the more likely it is that you'll be able to pull the trigger soon enough. Third lesson, self-referential feedback. By the way, I'm not sure why that screen's not working, but that happened earlier in the day at the conference that we were at earlier, so I'm not quite sure how I can fix that. Self-referential feedback. I think we need to be aware that certain kinds of processes, in some sense, embody the seeds of their own self-destruction. I know, and maybe not everybody's like this. I am a risk manager, not a trader, okay? But when I'm on the highway, if I'm going 75, 80 miles an hour, and I've got plenty of distance ahead, the road is clear, the road is dry, I'm not really terribly uncomfortable. But if somebody pulls in and cuts my lead distance in half, well, I start to get a little bit of anxiety kind of welling up, and my instinctive reaction is to ease off a little bit, to give myself a little more leeway. For some strange reason, and I'm can be as guilty of this as anybody, in capital markets, too often we see something going on which might not be sustainable, but boy, everybody's making a lot of money, and your reaction is you got to pile in and get in your share of the money that's being made. There's this kind of sense of, oh man, this is a freight train that I got to get on and ride the freight train. And so I think, in effect, what happened is the huge expansion of subprime mortgage debt set the stage for a more serious crisis when conditions ultimately began to worsen. These are what the data look like in terms of subprime originations. Back here, 2001, 2002, originations were $150, $200 billion a year. That was 6 to 7% of total originations in the U.S. housing market. By 2005, 2006, those originations had basically tripled, growing 30, 40, 50% annual rates. Now, one of my favorite sayings these days is, you know, if you see something that can't go on indefinitely, it will stop, right? The only question is, will it stop with a whimper or a bang? And as we've seen all too often, when you get those kinds of growth rates, they don't just ease back to some kind of sustainable level in an orderly kind of way. More often than not, they stop in terms of some kind of a wreck, right? So essentially, I think we need to keep in mind that the kind of things that drove these mortgage outstandings up to 14% of the total was just a process that couldn't go on indefinitely, and therefore that alone should have been some kind of an indication that we needed to think about it. So I think in this whole process there were actually two different kind of self-reinforcing feedback loops that were going on. One was in the context of the market itself. Unique innovation, in this case the structuring of subprime mortgages into marketable securities, generate attractive returns for the organizations doing the structuring. That leads to a growth in volume. You know, if you structured it this quarter and you made money, well, we'll do three times as much next quarter, and so will the competition, right? It becomes something that, as long as it's successful, seems to make sense. Well, except in this case, to achieve growth in volume so we can all enjoy these margins that are being created by this underwriting process, you had to have more material to put in the market. Well, how do you do that? I mean, normally mortgage volumes grow roughly in line with household formation. Well, the one way you could do that is you start giving mortgages to people that didn't traditionally qualify for mortgages by relaxing underwriting standards. That's one of the things that happens structurally. You also could get fancy with the way you did the compound repackaging. You could do CDO squareds and so on, increasing the whole complexity. As we know, in the end, you could actually build, this is synthetic subprime mortgage portfolio. This is exactly what is the subject of the whole SEC lawsuit against Goldman Sachs, is that this was a synthetic. There were no real underlying securities in a portfolio. All there were references to specific mortgages around the country that were reference assets, not really anything that was in a portfolio that had been underwritten. We can talk a little later. I actually think the SEC is probably on the wrong side of this one. I think if caveat emptor was ever supposed to be, you know, the rule of the day, it was with these people. It's not like they were selling this to widows and orphans. They were selling it to big sophisticated institutions, but that's another story. Anyway, so that's one of the things you do. You increase the complexity. One of the really important things that comes out of this, I think, is that I've already told you, I said, the data you had leading up to the crisis going back, let's say, to 2001, 2002, was actually fairly thin on the ground as the basis for coming up with the risk estimate you had to begin with. One of the things that happens in this process is you're progressively changing the structure of the underlying market itself to be something quite different from what existed up till 2001, 2002. So not only were the risk estimates a little shaky to begin with in terms of the empirical foundations of them, but now you're into a state of the world that is progressively departing from the state of the world that generated most of the data that you had in the first place. But as long as you continue by these various methods to create profitable, you know, activities out of structuring these things, well, you continue to try to grow the volume. But the more they grow, the more you have to push on the underwriting standards, the more you have to push on complexity, and you build up this thing, which I said earlier, my friend Stuart Turnbull said, I need to call dark risk. His point was, what's going on here is underlying structural tensions in the system that don't immediately change the way we usually have traditionally come to think about risk, i.e. daily volatilities, value at risk, these kinds of measures. In fact, in some cases, some of these kinds of things may actually damp that volatility, you know, because in fact, you're continuing to stoke the housing price, that's making the mortgages turn over effectively, that all seems to be ticking along, so that the kind of surface measures of risk don't really indicate what's happening below the surface. I've said, and ultimately what happens eventually, that tension gets big enough and you get some kind of a major explosion, a catastrophic break in the system. The analog that I think comes closest is the whole process of trying to predict earthquakes, you know, shifts of the tectonic plates. You can do seismic readings along the tectonic plates where they meet, and you know, scientists do that, but we've never, and I suspect in any foreseeable future, will not be able to parse those seismic readings in a way that gives us a 7-day reliable advance warning when there's actually going to be a sudden shift in the plates. The pressure's building up, and it's similar with avalanches, that now there's a tipping point, and now you get a sudden catastrophic change in the system. That's the kind of thing that I think is going on here. The second self-referential feedback loop that I think was going on is that you had an initial economic shock. My own argument would probably be one, you know, the period of the run-up in oil prices that had a disproportionate impact on the financial well-being of lower-income working-class households, which may well have been part of the reason that you began to get, as you saw in late 2006, actual declines in housing prices, at least on a 10-city index. So an initial shock creates some home price pressures. Prices actually start declining. Defaults are magnified because now a lot of these subprime borrowers can't roll over their loans because, in fact, you know, the house isn't sufficient collateral now to make that feasible. But the volume of those defaults was actually magnified by the fact that we'd had this huge increase in originations over the previous several years. But the increased number of defaults meant that bank credit losses were greater than they otherwise would have been. So banks pull back quicker, more stringent conditions come into play, more houses are being foreclosed because of the volume that's outstanding. Those houses are being put in the market so the banks can get their money back. But of course, what's more houses in the market do? It puts further downward pressure on home prices. And now again, you're into one of these kind of self-reinforcing feedback loops that results in a compound economic impact of the whole process. Now this is the kind of thing which most of the kind of tools we use as risk managers don't really address. And to some extent, having come into the field for macroeconomics, I tend to feel a lot more comfortable with this, I think, than a lot of people coming from electrical engineering or physics or the hard sciences, because, you know, it's there is a certain sense in which we have to be prepared to use our judgment beyond just the mechanics of the numbers, because the numbers only, first of all, tell us what's in the past, and sometimes we can begin to see structural things going on if we just open our eyes, but we have to be open to the possibility of thinking about these things and reacting to them. My fourth lesson, complexity and dark risk. This is where you have to love Google, I have to tell you. I mean, I do a lot of these presentations, and I like, as you can see, I like graphic images to try to illustrate the points I'm trying to make. So I'm constantly searching around for images for certain things, some of which are rather abstract. And I decided I wanted an image for complexity. Sometimes I have an idea what image I'd like to find. In this case, I didn't have a clue. But I went to Google Images, and I typed in complexity, and this is the first thing that came up. I mean, if that isn't the graphic image for complexity, I don't think I've ever seen it. My point is, we have to be careful here. It's easy to condemn complexity. In truth, I like to say, to its great discredit, the world is really a complicated place. So I don't dismiss the idea that you have to have some significant amount of complex analysis to try to get some even a reasonable approximation to the way the world works. But we do need to understand that especially complexity, which is what I call gratuitous complexity, complexity which is sort of built into something largely just to make it more opaque, to make it harder for buyers to understand, and so that the dealers can actually charge a higher spread. Particularly when you combine that with fairly limited data on historical experience around whatever this complex entity is, ultimately breeds a kind of fundamental uncertainty, an irreconcilable degree of uncertainty that just cannot be addressed in the same way that we tend to think about trying to tame risk through distributional analysis. And there's not a real answer for this, other than we just need to kind of think about where we have a level of complexity that is creating this kind of fundamental uncertainty that is getting in the way of our ability to deal with it in the same way that we normally do. A lot of my friends say, okay, yeah, I like the complexity, but I prefer the monkey. Okay, so anyway, be that as it may. Last and final lesson, I don't have any pretensions that these are all the lessons we should learn, but these are some of the ones that emerged when I was thinking about sorts of things that we probably neglected in the lead up to this crisis and that we should, as risk managers, take to heart and begin to try to pursue the next time around. I, as was implicit in the introduction, I spent 13 years as a talking head econometric model builder and forecaster. And after about 13 years, I wandered into financial risk management. And it was the first time in my career that I began to have active interaction at a professional level with traditional commercial bank lending officers. And one of the first things that I began to hear whenever I had a conversation around granting some new credit facility was, what is the second means of repayment? I say that to some bankers today, and I get whatever. If they're anywhere near my age, they recognize that old mantra. The idea was, whenever you make a loan to an individual or a firm, it is the potential future earnings of the corporation or the individual, which is your primary source of repayment. You make a loan to an individual to buy a house on the presumption that the current and the future career prospects will generate enough income that the individual can service the loan as required, and ultimately will be able to pay off the loan effectively in time. That's your primary source of repayment. But oh, by the way, you still are going to insist on having a lien on the house. Right? If the first means of repayment doesn't quite work out, you have an alternative, which is you can seize the house and sell it on the market to recover all, or hopefully all, but certainly most hopefully, of the money that you have lent. That's the whole point. Now, as an aside, the great fallacy of the subprime mortgage market is that it fundamentally violated this first principle of sound lending, right? Because you knew up front you were making loans to people who did not have the earning potential long term to service the loan as written. The only way you were going to get your money back was through appreciation of the collateral. So you had one and only one means of repayment, but that's an aside. The argument I'm making here is that I think in capital markets we should adopt a similar mantra that I haven't really heard, and that is, what is the second means of valuation for some any type of instrument, especially some kind of derivative instrument? Now, the problem is that when markets are active, you know, the trading floor is crowded, the screens are brightly lit, you have lots of liquidity, buying and selling is easy, two-way deal flow is significant. One of the things that comes out of that is very, very clear prices that no one will argue in terms of, this is an objective value to place on this thing, because at the margin, in reasonable volume, you can liquidate these things at this observed price. The problem arises when the screens grow dark, the trading floor grows quiet, liquidity goes from a rush to a trickle. I think that's probably the American side of Niagara Falls, by the way. One of the consequences of that is a lot greater uncertainty enters into the picture around what's an objective value for that particular item. And this creates some pretty serious problems. Now, this is not new, although it's actually newer than I had sort of realized, so I went back and looked at it. It's really only about 2005 that accountants introduced this concept of level one, level two, and level three assets. Level one assets are those with observed prices in actively traded markets. Level two assets are those with observable prices in inactive markets or observable inputs to accepted pricing models. Level three is assets with few or no observable prices or models that require significant unobservable, judgmental inputs. Now, if you think about it, as you go down from level 1 to 2 to 3, what's happening is you're introducing a great deal more play, a great deal more uncertainty around what is a clear objective value to be placed on any particular instrument in each category. Now, one of the things that I think is worth thinking about is, let's take four different types of instruments: interest rate swaps, single name credit default swaps, corporate collateralized debt obligations in 2006, and subprime CDOs also in 2006. I would contend to you that all of those were level one assets in 2006. I said earlier, a major U.S. pension fund sold significant holdings in 2 days, hardly even made a blip in the market. Just, you know, there was that much liquidity sloshing around in this market at the time. Most institutions do have certain ground rules that you will not have more than X in level three assets, more than Y in level two assets, usually based on the level of your capital. Those rules wouldn't have had any impact. These were level one assets. They would not have fallen under any of those limit restrictions in terms of, you know, proportional holdings of these types of instruments. So the problem, I think, is that we've thought about the problem in only one dimension. We've thought about it in terms of ease of current valuation. I would argue that we need to add a second dimension, which is, what is the effectiveness of alternate means of valuation if liquidity should fail? Okay, and I would argue that maybe accountants have not been sufficiently imaginative, but we need to add a third column, which I would define as level question mark. And my scientific definition of that is put your finger in the air and take a guess. Okay? Now, I think an interesting exercise is to try to put ourselves back in 2006 and say, what if we had used this framework and we had taken these four assets and we had said, where would they fall in this more expanded layout? Well, first of all, they're all going to be in this first row because they're all level, I said earlier, level one assets in terms of ease of current valuation. Now, my own sense is that interest rate swaps would pretty clearly fall in the first box, level one, potentially falling to level two. Essentially, if you have a yield curve for the currency in question at a credit spread that is appropriate to the benchmark, you can back into almost any customized interest rate swap and back out a reasonably objective value that would not be very different from the conclusion other analysts would get for the same thing. There's a bit of a problem in a crisis in terms of the counterparty risk of these things, and that certainly has to be taken into account. But I think, in general, certainly at the mid-market level, you'd be able to back into something pretty objective. Somewhat more controversially, I would argue single name credit default swaps I would put in the same category. You may remember when this market got started, before liquidity built up and it became the benchmark and the bonds were priced off the CDS, these were priced basically looking at the credit spreads on bonds. I mean, that's really what it is, right? It's the cost of the credit riskiness of an instrument relative to a sovereign debt that you deem to be have no credit risk. Now, it's not really that easy. It's a little dicier than interest rate swaps because IBM, for example, doesn't have a bond. It has a whole debt structure. It's got different maturity dates, different coupons, different call features. So it doesn't have a credit spread. You have to back out kind of a representative credit spread across the whole structure of debt. So it's, you know, there's a little more room for decisions that are not clear cut, but still I think you'd have something that would allow you to back into something. This is one of the things that annoys me when people condemn CDO and CDS because they don't have a clue what the difference is, right? And I would argue that CDS, certainly corporate CDS, when you get into CDSs that were written on portfolios of subprime mortgages, that's another whole story, but corporate CDS, I would say, I would put in that category. Corporate collateralized debt obligations in 2006, I would have probably put in the second column, level one, but potentially falling to level three. The reason being, so much of the value of a corporate CDO is tied up not in the riskiness of the individual entities, but in the covariability across the members of the portfolio. Now, this is the thing, of course, that we treated in the heyday of this market by implied correlation. But implied correlation was just an artifact of liquidity. If liquidity dries up, that's gone. You don't have that to rely on. Now, there's some things you could do. You could look at some past history. You could try to sort of, you know, come up with some approximation to it. Maybe you look at distance to default, expect the default frequency, look at the pattern of behavior through time. But it's a lot dicier proposition than what you would have to do, in my view, either for interest rate swaps or single name CDS. So I think you're clearly talking about it falling to something rather farther down the ladder than you would be the case with interest rate swaps. The problem, I think, is that if you'd been honest about it, even in 2006, it would have occurred to you that, you know, if liquidity in the subprime mortgage market dries up, you know, we're toast. I mean, there is just, there's so much variability, you know, it's such a messy underlying asset. At least with corporate CDOs, there were usually somewhere between 100 and 150 of these things that basically you knew what was in there, you could kind of deal with it. You had, you know, thousands of single mortgages. I know my friend Dan Rosen trying to struggle with this, and I'm sure it's a real nightmare to try to get down into it. It's just pretty clear that it was a whole more complicated problem to come up with anything, and in fact you were reduced to guesswork. And I would argue that by 2008, In some cases, single name CDS had fallen to a level two category. In some cases, corporate CDOs had fallen to level three with the potential of falling even further if markets got really worse. But I think the real essence of what triggered the crisis was that subprime CDOs fell literally off the chart. And one of the reasons I think that this whole thing metastasized from a somewhat confined problem in an obscure corner of the American housing finance market into a systemic crisis was that so much of it was actually held in the banking sector, which is at the heart of so much of the whole intermediation process of the economy as a whole. I can't really kind of defend these numbers as all that robust, but I went back and looked at the U.S. flow of funds accounts, and I tried to make some ratio analysis and some estimates, and I came up at the end of the second quarter of 2008, my estimate was that there were somewhere between $500 and $600 billion of subprime assets, subprime mortgages still on the books of U.S. commercial banks when you had slightly over $13 trillion of total assets. That was relative to liabilities and equity, where the equity was $1.3 billion, so that what we were really saying is that something like 40%, an amount equivalent to 40% of the book capital was actually tied up in assets around which, quite frankly, nobody really knew what they were worth. And of course, one of the things that creates is an inherent suspicion, distrust of the integrity of the financial statements of the institution. Now, speaking of Nassim Taleb, question, was this crisis a black swan? Was it something completely out of the blue that nobody could possibly have anticipated? Now, look, I started life as an economic forecaster. I am painfully aware that it's really easy to look smart after the fact, okay? I mean, that's just a state of the world. But I thought it useful to go back to something, and I say one of the difficulties of writing a monthly column for the last 11 years is you have to live with things that you wrote 3, 4, 5 years ago, and that's not always a totally painless experience. But I decided to go back to something that I did before this thing really got going. And I went back to May of 2006 when things were still fine. In fact, I chaired a panel at a conference in May of 2006, and the title of the panel was, "Where is all the risk?" Question mark. Tells you how much the world has changed in 4 years, okay? But it was. I mean, interest rates were low, volatility was low, there was almost an eerie sense of calm in the marketplace. And it really, it prompted having a panel discussion about, well, where might risk suddenly come out of the woodwork, right? Well, to try to put a framework around the discussion, I created the graphic that I'm about to show you. If I was doing it today, I would, you know, in the light of the aftermath of the crisis that unfolded, I would probably change it some, but that would be cheating. What I want to do is put up exactly the graph that I used for this panel. And I called it the risk puzzle, and the idea was each of these pieces was sort of some area where I thought maybe something could suddenly erupt and disrupt, you know, all of this nice, apparent, calm, low volatility environment. One was technological change, the fact that we are and continue to be in a period of rapid technological change. Sometimes we don't really have the infrastructure around security and other issues that keeps up with the pace of change, and it seemed to me maybe we could get into some mishaps that would arise there. Pace of innovation, I was thinking not so much sort of hard technology as more in the financial world, the new products that were being developed, the kind of things that were being marketed, et cetera, and were we developing all the surrounding infrastructure, the legal structure, the risk management oversight, and all of that to deal with them. Product complexity, was our analysis keeping up with the increased kind of complexity that was being built into these products? Model risk. Were the models, both the pricing models and the risk simulation models, actually adequate to the kind of complexity that was being brought into the things that were being created? Liquidity was one of the things I pointed to. Now, history says liquidity is usually there, but not always. As they say, it's there except when you really want it. Right? Or more to the point, when it's not there, suddenly you realize how much you really want it. So that was one of the things that I pointed to. Geopolitical risk traditionally has been a source of sudden upheavals, you know, revolutions in various countries, and certainly the whole Arab oil embargo in the early days of my forecasting career was one of the first of those. The Iranian Revolution, in many cases, was another disruption that was to some extent out of the blue. Commodity prices, speaking of oil prices, commodity prices have often been a source of sudden movements. And I mean, we've certainly seen this when oil went to 140 and then suddenly collapsed to 50. And they certainly have been a source of sudden volatility in the past. Extreme events, by this I really was thinking more like natural disasters, tsunamis, earthquakes. I mean, the Kobe earthquake had a significant impact on the equity market in Japan when that occurred. These are the kind of literally totally unpredictable events that sometimes can have economic impacts. Volume growth. You saw the pattern of the growth in the volume of subprime mortgages. Again, something that is growing at an unsustainable rate, that growth will stop. And so one of the things to look for, I think, was volume growth was unsustainable. External linkages, the fact that some events may in fact trigger other events. I've heard this quote, I haven't seen it verified, but supposedly Einstein said, the reason time has to exist is so everything doesn't happen at once. And I think to some extent, in a lot of our stress testing, we neglect this issue of external linkages because those linkages usually unfold through time. And we tend to go in and we shift the yield curve, we shift the FX rate, we do a bunch of stuff and say, well, how much would our net worth change tomorrow? Well, I think that's a useful exercise, don't get me wrong, but a real systemic crisis doesn't happen that way. I mean, this one didn't. This one unfolded through a kind of a loose sort of causal set of relationships where one event happens and it fundamentally changes a circumstance where something that might not have been a real threat, now at least you're vulnerable to a threat only because the first thing happened. And you get this kind of a chain reaction. And so thinking about some of these external linkages seemed to me something that we might want to think about. Operational risk. I have to say, I think the shabbiness of the operational infrastructure of the OTC derivatives market is damn near criminal. I mean, it's just, I'm really astonished that the business has gotten away for so long with not having an adequate operational infrastructure. And I thought the possibility of some kind of a major sort of problem there looked to me like it was at least a possibility of where risk could suddenly appear. Emerging markets have always been a problem in the past. In Mexico had always traditionally been a case where in a presidential election year there would always be some kind of an economic consequence of trying to overstoke the system or something. Really, it's the maturity of the political system in Mexico has advanced dramatically, but still, you worry about that, and in certain other Latin American countries that looks like it still could be a problem. Effective portfolio management, what I really meant here was perhaps questionable effectiveness of portfolio management. How many big institutions really have a handle on the whole broad portfolio in the things that constitute the bank as a whole? If you read the UBS report to shareholders about what went wrong, it took them several months to track down all the places that they had subprime mortgage exposure in their portfolio. So, to some extent, questions around the effectiveness of portfolio management in the big bulge bracket global firms, I thought was a question that perhaps was an issue. Information security, I was thinking in terms of loss of personal details that might undermine people's confidence. If I can't trust them with my personal identity details. How should I really trust them with my money? You know, that's the kind of psychological feedback that sometimes can occur. Regulatory uncertainty, this was 2006, and we were still in the final phases of trying to formulate Basel II and bring it into completion, and there were some loose ends to be tied up. That faded for a while, but now I would say regulatory uncertainty is back with a vengeance if we were to do this today. You need to have miscellaneous, otherwise people think that you've claimed you have everything, and which you obviously don't. And in an inevitable nod to Donald Rumsfeld, you have to have your unknown unknowns, which just really says it is important to think broadly about circumstances that just, you know, might not immediately present themselves to you. So within that framework, I think it's interesting to go back and ask ourselves, what if we'd had an offsite in May of 2006 and we'd gone through a series of products and activities that we were engaged in, and we got to subprime mortgage underwriting, and we said, well, would that have sort of lit up any of these boxes, and if so, which ones? And I would argue that I think the answer is probably yes, and I think pace of innovation is probably one. You know, these were something that hadn't been done before. The complexity of how they were structured in 1.5-2% tranches, supposedly that we could distinguish the pricing of them, what we really had done is construct things that were, if you invested in just one tranche, was really digital. You either got your money back or you didn't. I mean, the idea that you get a partial payment on a 1.5% tranche was a pretty unlikely event. Product complexity, because of the narrowness of the tranching, because of the fact that we were even doing some compounded, you know, we were taking residuals of one and making it, you know, the input to another future structure was creating a massive amount of product complexity. Model risk, frankly, the Gaussian copula model was a pretty thin reed upon which to build the CDO market, the corporate CDO market, let alone the sort of thing that we were doing with subprime mortgages. So I think that was a real serious question. Liquidity clearly should have been off the chart. And that, look, this was a market that was solely dependent upon the maintenance of liquidity. And if we thought it through and said, if liquidity failed, what would be the consequences? I think that one, you would have lit that one up pretty clearly. You saw the data on volume growth. I think that one would have jumped out at you. External linkages, the fact that a lot of this was being held in the banking system, you might have at least had an inkling that possibly this could spill over into much bigger issues because it was a threat to the institutions at the very core of the process. Commodity prices as a possible trigger, given that we were dealing here with obligations of lower income working class households where commodity prices, home heating oil, and motor gasoline are a bigger share of the household budget of these people, might have actually triggered some thought. The questions about how much of these were being held at the core of the banking system might have tipped us off. Look, I'm not going to claim if I was in a big bank and was responsible for this, I would have done as well as Jamie Dimon, who, quite honestly, probably saved J.P. Morgan, because I think from all the stories you read, I mean, he really went on a vendetta in late 2006 and said, we've got to get out of this. We've got to hedge ourselves. We've got to pull back on this because this could go up in smoke. And I think a lot of it was partly he was sensitive to the fact that housing prices were softening dramatically. Apparently, he also was getting feedback from their own retail mortgage operation that they were getting increasing late payments and defaults occurring in their portfolio, and began to realize that, look, it's not, that's one thing, but the wholesale side is another whole process that could cause us a lot of problems. But I would argue it's this kind of more structural framework that we as risk managers need to think about a great deal more than I think we have in the past, where we've sort of been involved too much in the mechanics of pulling together data, doing VAR models, VAR estimates, et cetera. So, summary, fairly quickly, statistical entropy, always go back and look at the adequacy in any plausible sense of the data that go into risk estimates, and judge their robustness accordingly. Use your structural imagination and don't really be so easily talked out of that. In particular, use that imagination to look for unrepresented variables that in any kind of existing analysis and track those variables carefully as early warning signals of a problem. Self-referential feedback, recognize that in many cases the success of an innovation doesn't necessarily mean that success breeds success. It may in fact create a circumstance which actually undermines the ability of it to continue that apparent pattern of success that has occurred to date. Complexity and dark risk, the fact that limited data and untested complexity ultimately lead to risk estimates themselves being inherently uncertain. And so take them with a much greater degree of confidence when you're dealing with something which is significantly complex. And second means of evaluation, when there's lots of liquidity, prices are very clear, people have significant confidence in the integrity of the financial statements that are based on those prices. When liquidity fails, prices become much less clear-cut, and in fact, one of the psychological feedback effects is people begin to distrust the integrity of the financial statements, and that can undermine the confidence that people have in the institution. So my sense is that we need to place limits on assets holdings that have no reasonable second means of valuation, even if they are highly liquid level one assets today, because we really cannot afford to be in a situation where something beyond our control shifts a significant amount of our balance sheet into an unvaluable status if it's beyond a certain critical proportion of our net worth. One final slide, and then I'm happy to take some questions. And I rarely get, you know, negative comments on this one because I talk to risk managers and not other people, but I think it really is crucially important to recognize an essential issue of any long-term viability of an organization is that you weigh the potential for loss against the prospect for gain. And the responsibility for that is not in the risk management department. The responsibility is the CEO and the board. They're the people that make the basic strategic decisions that shape the risk profile of the organization. You cannot control risk from the middle of an organization. It just doesn't work that way. I mean, the fact is, just saying give me 15% more than last year, don't give me excuses, give me the numbers. In truth, that is not sound aggressive management. That is, in the long run, a recipe for disaster. And if we don't learn that lesson from this particular experience, I'm not sure we're ever going to learn it. That's what I have to say, and I'm happy to take some questions. Mm-hmm. Actually, that was level three, I think. Corporate CDOs I had sliding into level three. Okay. Well, let's see which one. What's the one here? Come on. This is it. No, here it is. Oh, wait a minute. I don't believe it. Wait a minute. Sorry. There we go. Is it? For the subprime? Well, see, it's not the outstanding volume, it's the amount that you're willing to trade on a given daily basis. It's the amount that people are willing to exchange, are ready to exchange willingly in either direction. So it's really the daily deal flow. So if you want to either to buy or to sell, there's enough volume on a daily basis that you actually have no problem sort of getting yourself into that daily deal flow. Just the fact that there's a lot more out. And in fact, sometimes that works the opposite way. There's so much out there that if people panic, then there's all of a sudden everybody wants to be in the market on the same side, and there's nobody on the other side, and the market freezes up. I think that's the key. You have to be careful. I mean, volume, in one sense, is the total outstanding stock, right? That's one sense of volume. The other one, other volume, is the amount, and actually three. The second one is the amount of newly created flow in the stock market is like new issues, right, would be analog. But then the third is the daily transaction in the secondary market, right, the buying and selling and exchange in the market of the stock that already exists. And that's really what we usually think about as liquidity. That is, if you need to change your position, your holdings of your share of the stock, what really determines the ease with which you can do that is what's the volume of daily transactions that are going on and people willing to shift their position accordingly. And that's what really, when suddenly the fear set in that, oh gosh, these things really aren't AAA near money market substitutes with a higher yield, they're just lousy securities. All of a sudden, the buy side dried up because people that were out of the market, like my friend from the pension fund, were not about to come in and buy anymore. And the people that had them were desperately trying to liquidate them. And there was really, in fairness, I mean, you got to remember, I mean, the best way to think about this is the stock is fixed, right? There's a certain stock out there in the market, just like the shares of a company. The supply doesn't change. They're out there. Somebody's got to hold those. All that changes is the demand, but then it's a question of how much does the price have to move to get enough people interested to hold the stock. And if you get a situation where the people that don't have it aren't willing to buy it at anything like the current price, you know, they want the price to go from 100 to 40, and people aren't willing to sell it anything below 90, then all of a sudden there's no transactions because the buyers and the sellers are so far apart that there's no way that they can, you know, make a mutually agreed exchange. Yep. Will it fix it? Or... Will, I'm sorry, right? Right, you think Basel III will not be effective? I'm inclined to say yes. I mean, I do think there will be another crisis, and insofar as it's prevented, it won't be because of Basel III. It may be prevented, at least postponed, because of the psychological impact that the trauma of this period will have on people for a while. I did a presentation yesterday at the conference that just completed, finished today, and I showed percent change in GDP in the U.S. from 73 to 82, and it's like all over the map. And then from 83 to 2007, 2008 really, it's just amazingly stable. You know, I mean, And positive, you know, consistently positive, and really remarkably stable. And I mean, I did the calculation. I mean, anybody, you know, by the end of that period, people who were as old as 45 had never seen any other environment in their professional life. In terms of the overall, some people had seen the .com bust. So if you were in the wrong industry, you kind of got burned in that one. But the overall economy was remarkably stable. And it, I think it bred a complacency about risk, a sense that this time is different. Beware, anybody tries to tell you that. I've heard that at least three or four different cycles in my career of 37 years, and it hasn't come true yet, and it isn't likely to. Yeah, to a degree. I mean, Well, yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, one of the problems we have is it's easy to find scapegoats, right? We want to blame the rating agencies, or we want to blame Alan Greenspan, or we want to blame free markets, or we want to blame the politicians, and they have their share too. The fact is, there's plenty of places to find blame and to lay blame. At the end of the day, we have discovered the enemy, and they are us, right? I mean, it's kind of the greed in that lurks in the human soul that is at the heart of why these things happen. Yes.
Your 5 points here, you, based on conversations that you've had with those decision makers, do you feel that there's enough in your 5 points to bring to try to repair repair that dysfunctional relationship, or is there yet more that CEOs and decision makers need to see before they can start looking at, tempering their decisions based on risk management?
I wouldn't claim that this is an exhaustive toolkit to solve that problem. I do think there was some tendency using sort of analytical risk numbers to make the process a bit too routine. The numbers sort of looked okay. Those same numbers have existed for the last several years and nothing bad happened. I guess I'm okay. The numbers haven't taken a big leap. Whereas, and I think part of the thing that you have to overcome, and this is a big problem, and I hear this all the time, that risk managers say, well, but the management just wants the number. You know, the number, right? What's our risk? Is it out of control? That's just not enough. I mean, unless senior management is willing to grapple with risk in all of its multidimensional complexity and look at different possible sources of risk and where things might suddenly arise, I think that conversation will never really be as adequate as it should be. Now, that's not, you can try as risk managers to foster that conversation. But at the end of the day, again, it has to start at the top down. And there has to be a willingness and openness and an awareness of the importance of spending senior management time in that conversation, in that dialogue, and not just get reports and say, well, they look pretty much like they've had the last several years. I guess I'm in sleep tonight. I think that is kind of an attitude that too often arose, that there wasn't enough willingness to try to delve into and really think about some of these more structural issues, but to just take the summary risk measures as if they indicated all things are okay.
But for those senior managers who are not yet convinced, is there something, are there points that can be used to get them to reconsider their position and reconsider the way it works?
Well, I mean, in that sense, I would think that kind of framework at the end, if you can try to get people to think about, well, where's the location of things that might create some substantial shifts in the environment in which we as a company operate, that would be detrimental to our success. is at least a way that you could begin to try to have that conversation. I don't think there's any magic formula. All right? You need, obviously, different people in that senior management level will have different kind of priorities, and probably different sorts of approaches will be successful. I don't think there's any simple way to say this is a thing. Right?